You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 5th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jacob Hacker, co-author with Paul Pearson on America Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Also on the program today, it is Wisconsin primary day, ladies and gentlemen. It's a big race, both for the Republicans and the Democrats. How many voters will be prevented from voting today because of Wisconsin's voter ID law? We'll probably never know the exact number. Meanwhile, Evanwell fails. Well, sort of. That's the one person, one vote versus one voter, one vote case. Was it the latest blessing to sprout, seated by Scalia's death? Probably not, but I wanted to say that. And the regressive left shuts down an anti-Islam protest in Texas with guns. New York's big family leave policy. And more evidence of lead's potential role in crime. All that and more on today's program. Let's get right to that story about the regressive left, because as you know, it's regressive left central around here. Maybe we should probably change that to Regressive Left HQ, so it's not confusing. Central. I'm starting to use different directions. So let's just call it Regressive Left HQ. Here it is. Wait a second. I pulled the wrong story. This story from April 3rd. An anti-Muslim hate group planned an armed protest outside a mosque in Texas on Saturday. The Bureau of American Islamic Relations, BEAR, this is a very clever play on CARE, which is actually an organization that works with Muslims communities, or is a Muslim organization. This is not. This is a group of Yahoos from Texas who surrounded a Nation of Islam mosque in South Dallas in an attempt to intimidate worshipers inside. However, members of the Muslim community were joined with those from the Black Panther movement, as well as the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, who stepped outside to face the then outnumbered protesters. Crystal Muhammad of the New Black Panther Party told local news Fox 4, this is an armed defense maneuver, making sure that our communities are safe and secure from any insurgents coming in. Fortunately, no one was injured. Police were in between the two forces. But Crystal Muhammad said, we don't allow anybody to come in and try and intimidate our brothers and sisters. The members of Bear left without incident. The Panther Party said, we will not allow them to come to South Dallas with arms and intimidate our people, said Yafuf Bal Ogun, spokesman for the Huey P. Newton Gun Club. We're taking a defensive posture, but we're not threatening anyone. It's a people's victory here in South Dallas today. You will recall that it was the old Black Panther Party showing up, I believe it was at Oakland City Hall, with shotguns in California in the mid to late 60s, which convinced Ronald Reagan, who was then a governor of California, maybe it's time for gun control in this country. I think you are going to see more of this type of conflict in these open carry places going forward. And as you know, there are more and more states that are pushing this type of legislation. Georgia, one of those, I think, has it now. So, I mean, at one point, someone's going to realize, like, what's good for the goose is good for the other goose, or whatever that saying is. Apparently, these guys from Bear did not expect to be met with more guys with more guns. And thus, they left without incident.
We really need to look into gun control, man. I mean, you know, people are just out of control with it, you know? They're carrying
sensible
it outside.
Gun control, very important.
I mean, there's a lot of conspiracies floating around about taking away guns and whatnot, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about sensible, common sense measures to make sure they don't fall into the wrong hands.
Measures like you cannot carry a weapon out of a place of worship. You cannot carry a weapon if your back is to a place of worship. Only looking at one.
And in addition to that, measures like you can't own a gun if you're black.
Exactly.
And do I really even need to say Muslim?
Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever asked yourself why razors are one of the only products in a drugstore that are locked inside a plexiglass case?
I have actually asked myself that.
I have, and I just assumed it was, of course, these classic retail outfit unions just trying to get more work for the clerks. And I went up and I found out, no, they're not unionized, actually. And
not at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's because razors are so overpriced and small that people are actually more likely to steal them than just about any other product in the drugstore. That's because you'd slip it in. That's why they put them in those like huge like containers too.
It's like something from Ocean's 11.
Yes. It's like this stuff. Will you get this huge razor out of the drugstore? Well, you could attempt to do that. Of course, it's illegal. That's shoplifting. But why even bother? You don't have to. Harry's.com is the only shaving company that has both amazing quality and low prices, and you don't even have to go to the store. They ship them directly to you. German-engineered five-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shave, no cuts, no burn, quality guaranteed, full refund if you're not happy. I only buy things with a full refund if I'm not happy because I'm generally unhappy, and so it works out in my advantage.
I was going to say, with you specifically, the whole not happy stipulation is very dangerous from any company's perspective.
I have checked on that. You have to be not happy specifically with the product.
Okay,
it's fair not. I bought your product. I'm still vaguely unhappy. You get factory direct prices. You cut out the middleman, ships right to your door. They sell their blades at half the price of the leading brand. Over 1 million guys have already made the switch. Thousands more switch every day. The Harry starter set, called the Truman, is a great option for new customers and an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of this program. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Go to harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Make sure you use the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout to let them know who sent you. Even if you're returning, you may not get the $5 off of it, but $15 for that is still an amazing deal. Just let them know. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jacob Hacker.
Things on the ground. We gotta dig it up some.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor Jacob Hacker, the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and the Stanley B. Rezor Professor of Political Science at Yale University, co-author with Paul Pearson of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Jacob, welcome back to the program. It's been actually, I don't know if you remember, but it's been about 5 years.
I do remember. It was back when Paul and I had another book, Winner Take All Politics, about the way in which our political system was implicated in the rise of inequality in the United States. And so now we're back. It's
That's
great.
Right.
It's great to be back.
And I want to circle back to that after we talk about your latest, because that book was... if not prescient, at least pointing out something that was clearly in the ether and was about to erupt over the coming months after that was published. But let's stick for a moment with America's amnesia. Basically, you say that we forgot as a country about the fact that the mixed economy made this country what we appreciate, or made it prosper. What is the mixed economy?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's our core argument, that we've forgotten. And I want to be clear that we don't think that forgetting is just some benign falling into some happy forgetting. I mean, it's really about the attacks that have been on government for over a generation and on our received wisdom. You know, it was really the case that in mid-20th century, both the moderate Republican part of the Republican Party and much of the business community supported this mixed economy, which was the idea that you needed to have a strong government alongside vibrant private markets. As we put it in the book, drawing on the analogy of the political economist Charles Lindbloom, that we think of the relationship between the market and government as like the relationship between the strong thumb and nimble fingers of the market. And you need to have both to be able to grasp prosperity.
Let's talk about the role of regulation in terms of a way to make the economy work for people and a way to make markets work for people, but also a way for markets to thrive.
Yeah, well, so exactly. And I think it's really striking that when you hear, you know, conservatives talk today about what it takes to grow an economy, they say, you know, we need to have limited or little regulation. We've got to have, you know, a smaller government, less spending, and, you know, we've got to have big tax cuts for the rich. And what we try to show is that none of those were the core elements of what made the mixed economy tick in the 20th century, and they're not the elements that we're going to need today if we're going to reclaim the kind of broad-based prosperity that was once our hallmark. So regulation is part of it, financial regulation in particular. But another part of it, of course, is the big kinds of public investments that we made in education and science and technology, the kinds of investments that made possible Silicon Valley and most of the technological wonders that we have today. On regulation, I think the thing that people often forget, they think about, oh, no, you know, we've got all these things clamping down on innovation. But the kinds of regulations that have been most effective, like the Clean Air Act, are mostly about limiting the degree to which private market actors are basically pushing their cost onto other people. Right. That's true in financial regulation too, right? It's about the systemic risk that these financial players are taking on and Wall Street is pushing onto the rest of the economy. And it's just been an enormously positive development that we started to regulate these so-called externalities. The Clean Air Act has probably added around 2 years, along with other clean air regulations, 2 years to the American lifespan since the 1970s. And in some cities, there was recently a piece in the Times about this. In some cities like Wichita, Kansas, the home of the Koch brothers, it's probably added about 5 years to the lifespan of people living there.
Talk about there was a statistic about children under the age of, or I think it was toddlers, and in terms of like milk and water, just the these basic tenants. Because you know, as luck would have it, I interviewed someone yesterday on the idea of regulations, a law professor on the idea of regulations providing freedom and wanting to sort of speak in the parlance of libertarians. And I get a lot of libertarians who call the program and don't seem to have an awareness, and this is part of that amnesia, I guess, of just what life was like in this country in, let's say, just the big cities, for instance, without basic regulations. You know, I mean, I hear still people complaining about pasteurizing milk, for God's sakes, why? I mean, tell
yeah,
this to
I
people.
Mean, look, I mean, there is a funny, you know, there is a funny way in which you have a libertarian streak on the left as well, right, which now is up in arms about vaccines and, and pasteurization, although, you know, the right is just as crazy about vaccines in many cases. So let's go back to the early 20th century and look at a typical American city. This is where growth was happening. The cities were increasingly where the economy was industrializing and expanding. But in those cities, as many as 3 in 10 kids were dying before the age of 1. I mean, it's just shocking if you look. And it was mostly because of unclean water and milk, and the fact that there was very little in the way of medical treatment for even basic infectious diseases. So over the course of the first 30, 40 years of the 20th century, life expectancy increased by roughly 16 years in the United States, from, you know, the mid-40s up to almost 60 years. And that really came from cleaning up the water, which was a big government effort, and making sure kids had access to clean milk, and from developing vaccines, which, again, although the basic science was often done under private auspices, ramping up the production of vaccines was really a public project, and so too with antibiotics. Later in the century, the penicillin movement, the penicillin effort was basically a massive Manhattan project to develop penicillin. So. And it continues to our present day. I mean, we hear in Flint, Michigan about this horrible breakdown of government. Right. It just reminds us how important it is to have an effective government. But one thing we should remember is that in Flint, Michigan right now, about 6% of the kids in Flint are above 5 micrograms per deciliter, which is kind of the upper limit of what people say lead content in people's blood can be. And if you went back to the 1960s and 70s, you would see average lead levels among preschool kids of between 20 and 25 micrograms per deciliter, average levels. So that was another case where private industry decided that lead was a great thing to put in the gas to prevent NOx in the engine. The DuPont company tried to hide the horrible effects, but it became very clear that this was killing people, but even worse, it was creating a whole generation of kids who had less impulse control, lower IQ, probably was a big contributor to the crime wave that occurred over the last 30 years and its decline. And so the cleaning up milk, I mean, cleaning up lead and getting us down to the level where Flint is an aberration, not one that's unknown elsewhere. There's other cities that have serious lead problems, and we know how to fix them, and we're not doing it, and that's a tragedy. But it's still the case that we use government very effectively to deal with this scourge until recently, and as a result, we have a much safer and more prosperous society.
Well, I mean, there's sort of this duality, right, between the regulation and innovation in some ways. I mean, these are almost flip sides of the same coin. But I want to stay on that lead for a minute because I had just, Kevin Drum had linked to another piece today about another study showing a possible, and it's not quite established, that it's there's a direct causation to the massive crime drops in the 90s. Across the world, but there's a lot of evidence for it, and there's certainly some correlation. But that's one where the government didn't even necessarily wasn't doing it for the sake necessarily of for crime statistics. It was just sort of a unintended, very positive consequence. But I mean, I want people to absorb this notion of externalities a little bit because we see this even in the context of milk production, right? I mean, we can save some money by not pasteurizing, and that's not the dynamic today. But the idea is that someone's going to pay the price for that through the system, and that is a price that's sort of just one that they don't have to absorb by making their product safer.
That's absolutely right. I was going to just jump in and say that it's true that it wasn't clear what all of the benefits were of removing lead, but it was absolutely understood that it had terrible effects on kids' psychological and intellectual development. So the fact that crime probably came down in large part, I think, because of the removal of lead, and that's still a contested hypothesis, but I think there's a lot of evidence for it. That you're right, that was an unexpectedly wonderful development from this larger initiative, but of course there was a lot of evidence that this would be helpful. And I think the same thing you can say about milk, a big part of the story here is increasing knowledge, right? The degree to which prosperous societies are knowledge-based societies that invest in science and research and development, I mean, enormous amounts of investment. I mean, for much of the 20th century, and particularly from the 1940s through the 1960s, we were the country that developed institutions of higher education and invested in science. And we're unfortunately falling down on the rankings in recent years. And that allowed us to get better understanding of what caused infectious diseases, of what kinds of treatments would help. And the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, those were the brainchild of a conservative Republican named Vannevar Bush, who ran the Defense Department's scientific efforts, including the Manhattan Project, during World War II. And it's just a reminder that this was not seen as being a controversial issue for much of the 20th century. And so the last thing I would say about this idea of externalities, and just to clarify, so it's exactly right, and it's the flip side, as you say, of innovation. Innovation requires investment in kind of the basic science that no individual entrepreneur has a big incentive to invest in, because, of course, the results of that investment can be garnered by everyone. The individual investor can't capture that gain. Well, a positive or negative externality is basically a cost or benefit that's associated with production or selling of a good that doesn't get captured by the people who are involved in that market transaction. So pollution is a great example. Neither the buyers nor the sellers, right, have to pay that cost. The rest of society does. And that's what, you know, we have another example of something where we're starting to understand really fundamentally. We've understood for 30 to 40 years, but now the new evidence is just overwhelming that climate change is the gravest threat our planet has faced. And it's a result of the biggest externality the world has ever seen. And we're going to have to put a price on carbon emissions so that those market actors, the buyers and the sellers, price that into the transaction. And government is the only way in which we can do that. The private sector can innovate to respond to that new price, but it cannot put the price, because that requires government acting on our behalf, saying to people that you have to pay this price.
Talk about, I mean, you start the book by sort of comparing and contrasting, I guess, the two generations of Romneys.
Yeah.
And this is
a bit of a trip down memory lane. I think most of us have almost forgotten Mitt Romney, but to remember his father, George Romney, takes a real rummaging through the historical record.
Well, yes, and God willing, we won't have reason to remember the son come July. But tell us how far the apple fell from the tree, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I think that the thing that the transit from George to Mitt Romney tells us, it's not just about these two men who were both blue state Republicans, who had, you know, one was governor of Michigan, George Romney, the other was, governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, who ran for the presidency. They were seen, even Mitt was seen as relatively moderate by the standards of his party. And they were also business leaders, and they were leaders of the sort of iconic businesses of their eras, right? Automobiles, in the case of George Romney, who headed AMC, the Automobile Manufacturers Corporation, and and the National Automobile Lobby, and then Mitt Romney, who of course founded Bain Capital and was a financial wheeler dealer, and so. You just see in that transit the movement of the Republican Party to the right. George Romney was very moderate. He once turned down a big raise that was offered to him because he said it was too much. He, more important perhaps, was very outspoken against Goldwaterism. He said that, you know, the rugged individualism, that phrase, is just a political banner to cover up greed. And then he was a proponent of a more moderate Republican Party, and said that ideological parties can splinter the nation and we won't be able to get things done. Well, fast forward to Mitt, you know, Mr. 47%, who during the campaign in the less noted moment talked about how we shouldn't be helping kids get through college. That all that, I think, really illustrates that the Republican Party has moved dramatically to the right, that the business community has become much more Wall Street-centered and conservative in many ways, and that its leadership in particular has become much more conservative. And so we're living with the legacy of that in a lot of areas, and our book is really, American Amnesia, is really about how to address that.
That rugged individualism really resonated with me, because the part of that speech, that 47% speech that Romney gave that was surreptitiously recorded, that really struck out for me was his, and it was sort of an offhanded comment, but he claimed during there, and I'm paraphrasing, something to the effect of, like, you know, had my grandfather stayed in Mexico, I'd probably be president by now. And completely sort of like just assuming that his dad would have been governor and head of AMC were he to have a Latin surname, which of course would have been ridiculous at that time, highly unlikely. And so you've got Mitt Romney who really did embrace that rugged individualism and just sort of, you know, but it was a rugged in the sense that, like, you're in a Jeep commercial in a way.
Yeah. It's exactly right. I mean, I think that one of the points we're trying to make is that the biggest way in which government promotes prosperity, and there are many, is by promoting knowledge and science, and that kind of knowledge and science, as research has shown again and again, is really the foundation of prosperous societies, so that, you know, we can be so much more productive with the same amount of capital, with the same amount of labor. But you get this rhetoric that's basically about how there's these supermen and women, but mostly men, who are the job creators, who are at the very top of the economic ladder. And, you know, it reminds me of that joke that Ann Richards made about George Bush,
right,
that he was born on third base and thought he'd hit a triple, right? I mean, though, it's not as if getting from third base to home is not an achievement. And I think we should really celebrate people like Andy Grove, the former CEO of Intel, who passed away just recently. But we should also remember, as Andy Grove repeatedly said, that it rested on this huge public foundation. Grove went to a public college in New York City. He went to UC Berkeley, a land-grant college that was created in the 1862 Morrill Act, which gave federal land to seed new colleges. He went to a company, Fairchild Semiconductors, that was basically producing transistors and circuits for the Department of Defense. And, you know, the internet, most of the components of the iPhone, most of the major medical technologies, they all come out of government-funded research and investment. And we really shouldn't forget that, because we need that kind of investment in infrastructure and R&D again today. And because it allows a segment of the American elite to think that they're completely self-made, and not to understand the degree to which we need to have an effective government to ensure broad-based prosperity.
And we should say that when Andy Grove went to CUNY, it was basically free. Now, I know that sounds pie in the sky to people in this day and age, and
it
like that's
free.
Complete insanity. Like, that was back when we were when this country was communist, I think.
Right, under Dwight Eisenhower, right?
Right, exactly.
No, I know that he came in the 60s, but still, I mean, the most of these policies, the GI Bill, of course, made, since most young men had some form of military service at that time, it essentially made college free or very cheap for most Americans in that period. The Pell Grants used to cover almost all the cost of college and have money left over, all of tuition and money left over for room and board. And, you know, we've had this massive disinvestment in public institutions of higher education, which makes it much more expensive. There are other problems as well, to be completely clear, right? It's not as if you can always spend your way to better outcomes in some of these areas, and we're not arguing that. We're arguing, though, that we're not thinking about how to use government effectively. So we spend vastly more than any other country on health care, which is basically just padding the pockets of a bunch of already very deep-pocketed medical industry interests. Every other country gets better health outcomes while spending, you know, around half of what we do, and that's because our prices are so much higher. And the same is true when you think about the energy industry. It's basically making a lot of money by the fossil fuel side of it is making a lot of money by offloading the risk of catastrophic climate change onto the rest of us. And though Wall Street is doing better, there's still the fact that its business model in many ways rests on putting all that systemic risk that it's creating onto the rest of the economy and not bringing it into its own calculations. So that's the story we tell. It's about how you need to have that strong thumb, and that strong thumb, as you said, it's not about clamping down on valuable liberty. It's about making sure, right, that market actors are not doing things that have these huge negative externalities for the rest of society, and that innovation is going in the direction of producing things that are better for more people rather than the direction of creating more costs and difficulty for more people. And last thing I would say here is just, you know, a big part of this is figuring out how to have a democracy that isn't beholden to these narrow private interests. And I think we did relatively well at that for much of the 20th century. It's certainly after the progressive reforms and the New Deal of the 1930s, but we've been moving in the other direction. And we have to recognize that. You know, there's a lot of talk about crony capitalism, but part of the reason we have a government that's too beholden to narrow private interests is that our government is too weak. and not doesn't have the in-house capacity to deal with these growing outside pressures.
Right, and I would say that more often than not, when we hear crony capitalism, at the very least, introduced by the right, the fix is supposedly to make government weaker, and if this isn't a dynamic as opposed to some type of like I guess vehicle for cronyism. But I want to get to who is responsible for it, because I think there is I mean, it's clear obviously this is a project on the right, but there has been, it seems to me, some enabling by the Democrats. But before we get there, you wrote, and I think this was from an excerpt of the piece, that in the, or maybe I guess it was in response to it, in discussing this book with different audiences, we, and I, you're referring to, that includes Paul, your co-author, have been struck repeatedly how often thoughtful and informed people slip into describing government as if it were a vehicle for redistribution. Some favor it, others oppose it. But what's missing is an understanding that most of what government does is not about redistribution at all. It is about addressing a wide range of problems that markets alone are ill-equipped to tackle. You've mentioned that in terms of, like, you know, the development of all sorts of different products, that it's just not worthwhile for a for capital to attempt, because the downside risks are too high, because they may not share in the upsides exclusively. But isn't government on some level not the problem? Isn't that it's that people perceive it as a vehicle for redistribution? Is that we have a fundamental lack of understanding that government is the only means of distribution of society's resources. I mean, without government, nobody gets anything in any way.
So I think that's a restatement in some ways of what we're trying to say. So let me clarify what we're trying to say. I mean, you know, Paul Pearson and I, when we wrote American Amnesia, we wanted to remind both the left and the right, particularly the right, that, you know, that government wasn't just reshuffling the cards in the deck, but that it held many of the highest cards, and that, you know, to mix metaphors, that, you know, that it was essentially making the pie a lot bigger through these activities, not just slicing up the pie in new and different ways. And so that's, I think, what you're saying as well. I do think that what's striking to me is that so for the right, this has become, you know, a kind of maker-taker view of government, that basically, as the 47% comment by Romney suggests, that basically government is just giving money to people who aren't responsible and who presumably, you don't even have to say it, but sometimes Republicans do say it, that, you know, don't look like you.
Right.
And so that's just very corrosive, and it's, I think, behind a lot of the distrust towards government you see, particularly among white working class Americans. And it's just a misdescription of what government does, if you think about all of the range of activities. The second, on the left, I think the problem is more that that it's hard for us to, you know, and I count myself as on the left, and it's hard for us to understand that even with government as beholden as it often is to narrow private interests, that it's actually able to rise above those interests quite often and pursue the broader public good in ways that make us all better off. And that, as you said, there's a lot of democratic enabling, and I think it takes the form of silence, right? An unwillingness to engage on this crucial question of why we need to have government, and not just, you know, any government, but a government that is actively working to ensure our long-term prosperity. And so that, to me, you know, and you can see that most clearly, right, in the kind of the attraction of this these kind of small-scale government efforts, the nudge efforts that sometimes get written about. And you remember the stimulus package, right? Its big nudge effort was to give a huge payroll tax cut to all Americans in a way that nobody recognized, right? By decreasing the withholding of the payroll tax for ordinary Americans, which is probably good policy, but it was terrible politics. And I think we have to reclaim this idea that, you know, we have to be willing to talk about and embrace government, but not in some really abstract, broad way, right? You know, we can talk about specific things that government does, but it can't just be, we like Social Security, we like Medicare, right? It has to be the government's at the heart of protecting us from some of the great threats of our era, and it's also vital to our prosperity. It's not, you know, it's not as conservatives often say that what stands between you and growth, it's basically the only thing that will ensure that we have broad-based growth.
Or just growth. I mean, yeah. You know, without government, it's feudalism at that point. And it's and there's nothing, you know, there's a very small number of people who are going to gain anything. But let me just tease out and be a little bit more explicit on this nudge stuff, because, you know, from the early 90s, with the rise of the DLC and the first Clinton administration, or the Clinton administration, as in 96, Bill Clinton declared that the era of big government is over. Now he goes on to talk about the good things that government does, but that rhetoric from just a political standpoint, and, you know, he did raise taxes. And may have had a more aggressive agenda. People can argue that back and forth. But from a rhetorical standpoint, this is what they were pushing. And you can draw a line from that to what you say this nudge policy, which is a function of Cass Sunstein, whose number one agenda was, and I think, you know, Al Gore had similarly tasked when he was vice president, was, you know, how can we cut down on regulations, as if this is, I mean, that's not a bad thing to do, to reevaluate the quality of different laws at any given time. But as a stated agenda from a political standpoint, it seems to just sort of enhance that narrative. And if you're getting it from both of the two parties that, you know, we at least perceive as the political spectrum in this country, that's very problematic if you want to argue that government is an essential and a positive, institution.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so what I would say is, first, that this is why we wrote the book. And I think I think that if you know American political history fairly well, that you're going to find a lot of these landmarks fairly familiar to you. But the fact that we can bring together all of this economic research that shows that things like the Morrill Act or the interstate highway system were just fundamental to our growth, and that we're partly falling behind because we're not using government effectively anymore, I think that's powerful. And I think the other thing we're trying to do in the book is really to show how politically this happened. And I agree with you that the spiral of silence, as we call it, about government, and the degree to which even Democrats have bought into the kind of really distorted image, a negative image of regulation and other forms of government activity, I think it's just really a problem for the pro-government party. It's not a problem for Republicans, right? They're the anti-system party. And as we point out, they've gone from being sort of the party that works to moderate a mixed economy, which is one thing, to the party that tries to tear down a mixed economy, and which has won elections in part because it has demonized government. And you know, Dwight Eisenhower did not demonize government. Even Richard Nixon, who demonized a lot of people, did not demonize government. And it's really a shift that comes in the 1980s. And, you know, as late as George H.W. Bush, we still saw that kind of moderate Republicanism still having a place within the party. But its retreat and the way in which the business community has also retreated from a kind of acceptance and even use of government to pursue broader ends, I think is really the heart of our troubles today. And that's why we wrote the book.
Yeah, and I'm going to just talk a little bit more about that, you know, because I want to bring it back. Like I said, I think you were the first interview we had on this iteration of this program as back in 2010, I think it was.
Oh, I'm really pleased about that. And you know, and I hope that I can be back on again, that this will be this, you know, that this is just a, like,
we'll do it every 5 years.
But a landmark. Exactly. Just a little road marker on your long road to success.
But I think there was definitely a sense in the air that this question of an economy that was working only for a small number of people, following the in the wake of the financial crisis, there was a lot of, you know, Martin Gillins had come out, I think, at that time with a couple of studies to that effect, and this idea was certainly out there. And then, you know, a year later, people are camping out in Zuccotti Park for Occupy. Why this topic now? I mean, what is it's going on today, or I guess last year, or what was in the air that made you
see this as the fundamental, I guess, dynamic to write about at this time?
I'd like to think that we, you know, knew that Occupy Wall Street would happen, or that the Republican Party would be roiling, in part because of the growing inequality that is affecting Republicans as well as Democrats. But, you know, our real goal was to try to understand why we were the country that had just shot off the charts in terms of rising inequality. And that wasn't an overnight development, obviously. It occurred over 30 years. But as we wrote, I do think that we became more and more convinced that this would have a profound effect on our politics. And, you know, we started writing the book before the financial crisis broke. But of course it hit well before we were done. And that seems to me to be the kind of catalyzing event, because, you know, it did not lead to the kinds of fundamental reforms that we think would have been required. It did lead to some reforms, but what it did do, I think, was really cast in stark relief the fact that the economy had come to work had worked very well for a very small slice of Americans, and the rest of Americans not only weren't sharing in that in those gains, but they were the ones that suffered in many ways the most from the financial crisis. And the degree to which deregulation and the fact that both parties were so beholden to Wall Street, the fact that those things were so much a part of the crisis, I think also just made that a very hard conclusion to escape. And I'm pleased that it's become much more of an issue in American politics. I mean, what I think American amnesia is trying to do is to broaden the conversation, to recognize that in addressing inequality, the fundamental problem that we face is that most Americans, unfortunately, don't trust the vehicle for progressive reform, namely the government. And so we're trying to explain why that's it's wrong to have that profound mistrust of government, even though there are many ways in which government underperforms and is beholden to narrow interests today. And second, we're trying to show, you know, how we got here, and then finally draw from that prescriptions about where we might go. And I think we have, you know, in this book, better, more than winner take all politics, I think we have a set of realistic and ambitious reform ideas that would get us some way towards reclaiming the hallmarks of the mixed economy.
Is it in terms of convincing the American public? I mean, don't we also need a shift in rhetoric? I mean, you know, I think it seems to me like, you know, part of Trump's appeal on the right is they clearly want the services that government would provide. They don't think they're going to get it from government. They think that just Donald Trump is going to do it himself. I mean, that's his pitch, right?
Yeah,
like,
right,
I'll take care of it all. Don't worry. You don't even need to know how. Just trust me. But really, even from the Democratic Party, I mean, Are we hearing the rhetoric? I mean, you know, part of the reasons why there was a criticism of Hillary Clinton early on in her campaign was to sort of make this pledge about middle class taxation, as if this was, you know, going beyond and saying sort of restricting what the government could do in some way. And I wonder if you see in the Democratic candidates the rhetoric that would at least make the argument that government is explicitly, not just in terms of like, here's my ideas for what government can do, but the broader notion of government being a vehicle for prosperity.
I do see that. I mean, Paul Pierce and I wrote a piece in the Times about Clinton. You know, it's clear that we would be sympathetic to Bernie Sanders' call for significant political reform, but in our piece we tried to also draw out what we see as the kind of hidden progressive vision of Clinton, and a big part of our argument there, it really dovetails with what you're saying, is that we don't have a language right now for talking about using government in the ways that Clinton wants to, right, with family and medical leave and improving financial reform and the health care reform legislation of 2010. You know, there is a lot moving forward with more climate change initiatives and so on. There's a lot there, but it's really seemed very disjointed, as if there is no larger vision. And what we try to point out is that sense of there being no larger vision is partly because we don't, Democrats don't, our leaders don't, even when they believe in it, know how to talk about government effectively. And so that's the rhetorical problem. I think, though, that our view is that it's not going to change. It's not going to change unless we change the kind of structural incentives that political leaders have, and that's going to mean there's got to be the kind of pressure that, that Sanders is bringing on both Democrats and Republicans. There has to be that pressure to moderate, and not just to moderate, but to be more responsive to broad, diffuse concerns and not concentrated private interests. And then in turn, I think we have to take, we have to think much more politically about progressive reform. And that's, you know, the second thing I think is that it's just striking the extent to which a lot of Democrats in recent years have been really thinking technocratically about, okay, like, what's the best policy option in this circumstance? That's wonderful, but it also has to be one that will build over time the foundation for further reform. And, you know, that is going to be necessary. And then I think if that pressure occurs, you know, I do think there are a lot of corporate leaders that can be peeled off to support revitalization of our infrastructure, R&D investments. But it's not going to happen until there is, you know, really serious pressure and a sense that they're going to either be at the table or they're going to be on the menu. And that's what's happening with corporate interests. Even the progressive ones largely sit on the sidelines while Republicans trash what remains of the mixed economy. So we have a blueprint, but it's not one that's going to occur overnight. There's no magic bullet. But we think that you can create a kind of virtuous cycle to replace the vicious anti-government cycle that we're in right now.
Let me just, as a professor, final question. President Obama, on that larger question of having that language to sort of encompass the individual accomplishments that the government has pursued and executed under his administration, how do you think that he has spoken about that? And you can make it relative to your expectations, because I mean, for me, that was one of the biggest disappointments about President Obama, is that rhetorically he never did what Reagan did in the other direction.
Well, I think we often are too hard on Obama. I mean, I will say that first before I actually pile on like everyone else. So the first 2 years of his administration, he achieved a fair amount of progressive reform and under very difficult circumstances, right? And, you know, I think it's understandable why they downplayed the kind of broader political reforms and movement building efforts that were such a part of the campaign. I don't absolve them of blame for that, but I think that that they were clearly, you know, as we write about in our last book, you know, facing this situation where organized combat was really the first order of business. That said, I think that there was a major miscalculation by the president after 2010 in shifting toward a kind of austerity mindset, and he's only now starting to recover from that. And I think it's been pretty remarkable to see him sort of freed up in the last year and a half to focus more on climate change, to focus more on labor reforms that he can do through his administration, to focus on immigration reforms that so far have been stymied by the courts, and of course to focus on the courts themselves, right, where, you know, he is, you know, whether or not, and it seems like not, he's going to get a nominee through this year. I mean, it's certain the Republicans are going to do an unprecedented blocking of the replacement for Scalia. He's been changing the position of the courts, and if a Democrat's elected next year, there's going to be a large bench for the Supreme Court. But it's come very late in his administration, right? And it's, of course, come under a circumstance in which he just can't get any legislation through Congress. And so I think that the next president is going to have to, if there's a progressive president, he or she is going to have to govern with a very different idea about what the long-term vision has to be. And that, by that I mean it has to be much more focused on political reform and thinking about creating the conditions under which you can really push the business community and the Republican Party to the sides when they won't cooperate, or to the center when they will. And so I'll stop because you wanted to say something
else.
But
I was going to say, without getting nitpicky about TPP, I largely think that, like, you know, as I think Dan Pfeiffer said, they made a big miscalculation in terms of, you know, around that time when they pivoted to austerity. But I'm talking even less substantively than that. I mean, one of the things, like, I had, at the very least as a baseline, I had hoped for President Obama that when he said he wanted to be like Reagan in that interview, You know, I think a lot of people, it was a Rorschach for a lot of people. And my own personal projection was like, when Reagan said government's the problem, I wanted a president who, even if they didn't necessarily execute it that way, get out there and say government's the solution. And even with all the things that he's done since the 2014 election, it seems to me that that rhetoric has still not been there, that there is still this temerity amongst the establishment Democrats, as if, like, if we say this, people are, you know, we give them an inch, they're going to might want a mile at that point. I mean, there seems to be this temerity.
So, Sam, I think we're on the same page. And I was talking about the rhetoric as well, although less so than you are now. And I think he hasn't been as strong. And there have been moments where you've seen glimpse of his capacity to speak to this. But, you know, I do think, on the other hand, that progressives often fall into this trap of what sometimes called the Green Lantern theory of the right. presidency, right? Is that if only the president with his magic ring would be able to do it. And obviously it's going to take a broader movement to change the conversation, but you would like someone who's as obviously smart and clearly has great deal of understanding of and appreciation of many of the crucial things government does to be more forthright about it. But I do think that the larger Democratic establishment such as it is part of the problem, because it has been trapped in this sort of vicious self-reinforcing cycle of silence, and it's very hard to break out of that. But I think it's going to have to happen, because, you know, we're a country that's had for the last 40 years a great debate about government, in which basically only one side has been doing the talking, and the other side, while defending individual programs and sometimes speaking up on behalf of government as a whole, has mostly been trying to hold the line without speaking about the virtues of the policy position it's holding. So I think that's absolutely why we wrote the book, because we think there is a really good argument that you need to have a strong, effective government to prosper, and that that's as true today as it was in the 20th century, and maybe even more the case today because of the complexity and interdependence of our world. And if you think of the challenge of climate change that we've talked about, or the need to prosper in a knowledge economy, both those imperatives require an active, energetic government. So, American amnesia, we have to get out of it. And Paul Pearson and I wrote the book to try to show the way.
Well, I was just going to say, America Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, written with Paul Pearson. Jacob Hacker, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Sam. I look forward to coming on in 5 years.
All right, great. Maybe we'll
or even sooner.
Indeed.
Or even sooner.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Oh, folks, don't forget. I almost forgot to tell you this. This show relies on your membership to exist day in, day out. Every day we have someone email us saying, like, I don't like what you do. But then we also get, like, two people who write in, I do like what you do. I don't know why I raised that. This show relies on your support to exist day in, day out. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you, gosh, anywhere from, I don't know, half hour. Have we even done like a half hour, 40 minutes worth of a fun half ever?
I don't remember a half hour.
Not since you've been here, a new Matt. Or, you know, what seems like a 14-hour marathon show. So join today, support the program, keep it alive. JustCoffee.coop. Oh, did you mention this the other day?
No.
You did not, did you?
No.
I put it right out here for you. You totally forgot. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, in April, are you ready? 30% off Just Coffee. What? It's usually 10% off. No, 30% off. Just in April. If you want to buy the Majority Report blend, 30% off. If you want to buy some other blend, probably 30% off. There's a few future ones that are not. But 30% off, folks. You got to use the code MR Spring 16. MR Spring 16. You get 30% off your coffee. Do you know how it's like you could get into your car? If you got into your car and drove down to buy like your full bean coffee, I mean, don't even make me do the calculations, folks. It's a great deal. 30% off Just Coffee in April. If you've never had Just Coffee, now's the time to try it. 30% off. I just watched Michael get the shivers when I said that.
That was weird.
That was weird. Just get the shivers. I said 30% off, and he was like, ugh.
Well, that might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
It might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah.
But 30% off is not. That's exactly how much off you get. Use the coupon code MRSPRING16. 16 being the year, MR being the majority report, spring being the time of year. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Don't want to buy crap from Amazon? Good for you. Buy it from jet.com at our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Get 15% off your first purchase. Jet.com. All right, going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Hey! New episode of Two Dope Boys dropped today. Go to subscribe the number 2DB. Subscribe 2DB. Go to iTunes. Give it a review. We've got 95 reviews on iTunes. Maybe we'll give a special gift to somebody who's 100.
There's some great sexist audio on the Two Dope Boys for the brand F Up of the Week this week, too. So,
oh, well, that's always a huge seller.
And the Pope is on Instagram, and native advertising is getting sneakier and sneakier.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Two Dope Boys. Go check it out. You'll enjoy the show. You'll be supporting this show. What more would you want? All right, folks. See you on the fun half.